This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Welcome back. This is the Insight is Capital podcast. I'm your host, Pierre Daly. This episode, I'm excited to have Ilan Colette, Institutional Portfolio Manager with the Global Asset Allocation Team at Fidelity Investments, back on the show. Ilan brings a wealth of experience to the table with a deep expertise in Canadian asset allocation strategies and a strong focus on portfolio management and investment philosophy. He's been with Fidelity since 2014, where he's held key roles both in Boston and Toronto, including leading the Global Asset Allocation Group's inflation and commodities research. Before that, he was an editor at Bloomberg News and an economist at the Bank of Canada. His extensive background and unique insights into the global economy always make for a fascinating conversation about all things markets, macro, and asset allocation. Thank you so much for listening. And without further ado, my conversation with Ilan Colette. Ilan, welcome back and thank you for being here. It's great to have you back and to catch up with you.
Yeah, it's really great to be here. I always enjoy these discussions. I think the hardest part is sort of, you know, keeping them to less than 2 hours, but I'm excited for the chat today.
Yeah, likewise. I've been looking forward to this for a while. Ilan, what a year to date 2024 has turned out to be, right? I mean, despite all of the uncertainty that we have contended with, U.S. stocks are skirting all-time highs. Bond yields have receded, but, you know, I just noticed the 10-year U.S. At 392, which is not that much from its peak, from this year's highs. And so they've kind of wobbled here and they've gone down lower and then come back. We've got a no landing economic consensus for the U.S. economy. And then we've got the final exception to that, I mean, to what we're going to be talking about today as well. Aside from all the good news, we've got a far different and less optimistic outlook for the Canadian economy. So to begin, what are your thoughts on the Fed's bold decision to go and kick off easing with a 50 beeps cut? And then, you know, it's a bit of a compound question. What does the Fed's decision imply about the U.S. economy?
Yeah, I think, again, Pierre, thanks again for the invite. I really enjoy these chats. And I think that's a good place for us to start. You know, the way that the Fed communicated that 50 basis point cut was a strong start, right? That's how they sort of, they communicated it. And there's a couple of things for us to unpack in terms of the motivation for that strong start and what the implications are and what it means for the U.S. economy and the Fed's assessment of the U.S. economy. I spent the early part of this week at the 66th annual National Association for Business Economics Conference down in Nashville, Tennessee.
Right.
You know, interesting place for a conference. You kind of worry about the morning sessions, I think, in a place like Nashville, but everyone showed up. You know, it was a really, really productive discussion. Chair Powell gave a luncheon address on Monday, and I introduced him. And then on Tuesday, I was lucky enough.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite an honor.
It really is.
And on Tuesday, I chaired a session with Loretta Mester, who was the president of the Cleveland Fed for 10 years, and Seth Carpenter, the chief global economist for Morgan Stanley. So just, I mean, you know, for a nerd like me, this is like a 3-day curated TED talk for me to really soak up a lot of information. But let's really talk about this 50 basis point cut. And, you know, it comes from a few places. First, the U.S. is in the midst of a productivity expansion, right? I mean, we are in the midst of something pretty remarkable, I think. And this is a view that we first formed on our team, myself, David Wolf, David Tulk, the global asset allocators based in Canada. This is a view that we first formed a year ago, right? So October 2023, we wrote a paper called Potential. Probably right. the nerdiest paper we've ever written, but the most useful. And we sort of put forth this thesis that maybe because of investments in clean technology or advancements in AI or you know, really significant structural to the structural changes to the U.S. labor market, maybe the stall speed of the U.S. economy was higher. And by stall speed, I mean, maybe the U.S. economy could grow in the threes instead of the twos.
Right.
Still have slowing inflation, still have a healthy labor market, with and then get earnings to revise higher and stocks to push higher. And I mean, this is a view that we had in October of last year, and we implemented a material and significant overweight to US equities. And if you fast forward to today, we know what's happened, right? So
right.
I think we've seen a few things. We've seen the danger of betting against the US, right? I mean, again, I pulled some numbers this morning in preparation. The US has decidedly pulled away. The US economy in inflation adjusted terms today is 14% larger than it was at the start of 2019. Okay. The number for Canada is 7, right? So not bad.
Right.
The number for Germany and Japan is less than 1%, right? So we're in the midst.
That's incredible.
It really is. And so we're in the midst of this productivity expansion. We should talk about.
Well, yeah, I mean, like North America is like an island, right? I mean, we're like an economic island away from the Asian and European mainland. So
yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating. I think, you know, productivity expansions, they're very, very rare, right? And this will speak to the motivation for a 50 basis point cut. They're very rare. They're, you know, the last time we had one, again, I think I've mentioned this before, was when Al Gore invented the internet in the 1990s. And, you know, so in our lifetimes, we'll probably only have two or three significant productivity expansions. And we believe we are in one, right? And it's very hard because it doesn't show up properly in the data, right? So if you ask if you had asked me when I was sitting at the central bank 20 years ago, is the U.S. in the midst of a productivity expansion? I would have said no, because the trend and the data looks like it's just joined the trend that we had sort of pre-COVID. And so you have to be suspicious of productivity statistics, because again, it's not impossible that the statistical agencies a year or two from now say, oh, by the way, in 2024 and 2023, you were in the midst of a productivity expansion. These statistical agencies are very good at forecasting the past, but you know, we don't have that luxury as investors. And
right.
And again, to link it back to the first 50 basis point Fed cut, which again they'll refer to as normalization, is a productivity expansion is very, very hard to achieve, and it's even harder to keep going, right? The Fed, particularly the Jay Powell, that under Chairman Powell and Governor Waller, right? Remember that name, is a different type of Fed, right? These are not, I would say, sort of rule-following academics that have been raised in the Federal Reserve system. You know, their allegiance is really not to any specific sort of doctrine. They're data dependent.
Right.
And the 50 basis point strong start is a show that, you know, they're serious about keeping this really healthy economy going and sticking the landing. And so it's interesting. I mean, anyone who says they were expecting a 50 basis point cut is lying, because nobody was. Very few people were.
There was a lot of hope for it, right? Not so much expectations, but hope. Well, exactly. And that's an entirely different feeling.
Asked me the week before, I would have said not 50 basis points, because it will signal some urgency, and the Fed is looking at data that we're not seeing. But they've managed to communicate it as a strong start, right? Which is a remarkable thing. Now, the thing to note there is we've had a view for a while that the Fed wants to cut,
right?
The Bank of Canada has to cut, right? So there's a difference there. Fed wants to cut because, again, keep that productivity expansion going, keep a healthy labor market, pull in people who have historically not had a strong labor market attachment. That's another remarkable stat we should chat about. And in Canada, it's need to cut because a huge portion of homeowners are going to renew their mortgage, you know, between now and the end of 2026. We've talked about that
in extensively in our past conversations this year.
Yeah. So that's and sort of a need to cut versus want to cut.
That's also, I mean, that's a very big distinction to make, because, you know, I have this conversation with, you know, my kids all the time. I have to want to, two completely different ideas, you know, motivations, right?
Exactly. And,
I mean, the Fed just wants the Fed wants to stick the landing and have, you know, mission accomplished actually come true.
Exactly.
You know, for Canada, it's more of a, you know, it's more of a, it's feeling like more of a rescue mission at this point.
Well, that's it. Right? And, you know, it's interesting, Pierre, like this have to versus want to. I mean, that's a conversation I have with my kids too. I have to go see Taylor Swift. No, you want to go see Taylor Swift. But, you know, again, what is the situation in Canada, right? In Canada, since the start of 2023, we basically had almost no economic growth, right? That line is almost flat. In per capita terms, because of the explosion in population, it's a steep downward sloping line. We haven't had productivity growth. Now, that problem is sort of 30 years in the making. I mean, that's not a recent issue. And we have a household that is vulnerable. I mean, this is problematic, right? If 60% of outstanding mortgages approximately renew between now and the end of 2026, any sort of normalization in rates will dampen that sort of disastrous scenario of folks not being able to afford those renewals. Now, there will still be a portion of people that can't afford the renewals. But again, in historically in Canada, you know, we don't give back the keys. We have full recourse mortgages. You just cut discretionary spending to the bone to make sure that principal mortgage can get paid. That's the Canadian story. But again, the U.S., I know we were talking about this earlier. Again, I pulled in some of these stats. You know, it's remarkable what we're seeing in the U.S. For example, the number of disabled workers that have been pulled into the labor force has risen by 2.4 million people since pre-COVID. That's an increase of 40%, right?
That's astonishing.
That's astonishing. I mean, that's something that I think is going sort of unreported as one of the you know, this COVID silver lining that, again, that boosts, that could potentially boost potential growth. The other one is the prime age female participation rate. And sorry, I know we're getting nerdy here, but prime age refers to 25 to 54 year olds. Participation rate is the engagement in the labor market, is the highest on record for females. Right? And why is that? It's because, you know, you have a more flexible labor market that allows for some time not in the office, which, you know, if you're a new mother, that's a complete game changer. Again, yeah. I think a lot of this stuff is going underappreciated, and it signals a really significant secular change.
Those are both astonishing statistics.
They really are. And I mean, you know, again, I think it's going sort of underappreciated. The person to follow on,
absolutely,
you know, the person to follow on LinkedIn is this professor, Nicholas Bloom, B-L-O-O-M. He is really at the forefront of the research on the work from home, remote work revolution and what it's doing. He's a fantastic writer. So, I mean, if there's one good takeaway from our discussion today is everyone should really follow him.
Yeah.
He's at the forefront of it.
I'm going to look it up. Look him up. Nick Bloom. Okay.
Nick Bloom. I'll send it to you.
So talk about your attending the NABE. What happened there? Where did you learn?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been a member of the National Association for Business Economics, NABE, for 22 years. I think my first conference, 21, 22 years. My first conference was 2003 when I was like a junior economist at the Bank of Canada. And I've had a regular ongoing involvement with this association. It's basically the largest association in the world of non-academic economists, right? And which is a very different group than the academic economists. And last year—
So these are folks who work on Wall Street, in finance,
exactly. Or
who are economists at banks.
Exactly. Or large firms, right?
Large firms,
manufacturing companies or firms, right? So, you know—
Exactly.
And so a year ago, I got elected to the board of the board of directors of this association. And just so, you know, to provide some context, the board is made up of, you know, the chief economist of Ford, chief economist of Coca-Cola, chief economist of Caterpillar, chief economist of Morgan Stanley. So it's a mix of folks and me.
Right. And, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is because, I mean, if you have a question about supply chains or chip shortages, it's great to be able to pick up the phone and talk to the chief economist of Ford, right? So again, it's a great professional network. But what's happened is, you know, an increasing involvement and board membership means increased responsibilities, right? So the conference that was held in Nashville earlier this week, you know, I had the opportunity to introduce the session in which Powell was delivering his luncheon address to a room of about 500, maybe 20,000 people online. And it was an excellent speech. It was a very tight speech with a really productive Q&A. So the one thing that Chair Powell has been and has made himself very accessible to the NABE community in terms of answering Q&A in a very open and honest manner, right? So this is, I think, like the evolution of central bank communication is interesting to me because we've learned that it's okay to, you know, say that there is some uncertainty, like that's okay. And to sort of discuss how you arrived at the decisions you arrived at based on the inflow of data, right? So it was a very open discussion. The entire thing is online if anyone wants to check it out.
Right.
And then again, the next day I had a discussion with the former regional Fed president and another senior economist. But what I really gain from these conferences is, you know, the conversations that you're having really allow you to come up with new creative ideas. And then also just as important is the pushback, right? So I really appreciate it. I've known these folks a long time now. I really appreciate it when I sort of tell them my productivity thesis, which we just discussed, getting that pushback saying, well, you know, you don't want to overestimate it because the stats are showing this, right? And then that opens up another door in the brain to say, when I get home, I'm going to go down this rabbit hole and dig into this a little bit. So it's a great conference. You know, I know we're going to talk about the path of rates and the neutral rate and what it means for bonds, but I attended the NABE International Symposium in May of this year in Hamburg. I can't remember if the last time we spoke was before or after that, but you know, I sat next to the director, the head of research for the ECB. We were talking about the neutral rate at dinner, which is dinner time conversation with the ECB.
Right.
and you know, we were talking about the path of rates and normalization. And he sort of off the cuff said, what makes you think the US is not at neutral now? Meaning consumer spending is strong, the labor market is strong, inflation is slowing, businesses are spending. Why would we need to change rates at all from where they are now?
Right.
I mean, that was almost a fall out of your chair type of moment, right?
And we're talking about R star, right? We're talking about the neutral rate, which is not at 2.5. It's higher in your estimation. It's somewhere around 3.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, you know, this kind of links into the bond question, the investment grade debt question, and how we've been positioning the portfolios on the bond side. I mean, so sometimes the question is posed as, you know, neutral was 2.5. The Fed was at 5. We have 250 basis points coming our way. How could you not be unbelievably optimistic on the bond side of the portfolio? If you don't like bonds now, you'll never like bonds. That's sort of the thesis. And and honestly, we've been cautious around adopting that view. I mean, we've been underweight investment grade debt, both in Canada and internationally, and overweight the credit and the spread sectors. But when I think about, when I back up and I try to kind of remove the jargon out of this discussion, I think about the thesis around bonds are back as really being premised in the notion that the Fed was at 5, neutral's 2.5. We have 250 basis points of rate cuts coming our way. Arithmetically, mechanically, this is going to be a great time for bonds. And the primary reason in my view that we've not adopted that view is neutral is not 2.5, right? So if we are in the midst of this productivity expansion that I just discussed, right? Again, growth can print higher without stoking inflation. Inflation can slow, labor market can remain tight, earnings can push higher, equities can do well. The sixth one is neutral is higher, right? And neutral is not 2.5. It might be 3.5, right? It might be 4. We don't really know. I mean, the truth is, having spent almost a decade at the central bank in Canada, finding neutral is like trying to find your keys in the dark after a few cocktails, right? So it's it's like you've dropped your keys, you know, and it's dark, yeah. And you don't want to wake anyone up in the house. I mean, maybe I'm revealing too much here, but you don't know where neutral is. You find it in a very cautious and data dependent approach. And in the US, what I think that's going to look like is strong start cut by 50. Probably successive cuts will be 25, provided inflation continues to agree. Inflation continues its path that it's on, and the labor market remains healthy, as you saw this morning. It's doing just fine. And you find it in a slow and cautious data-dependent approach. And you don't, you're not just mechanically marching towards 2.5 or 3%. You don't actually know until you found it, right? And so because you remember last year we had 6 cuts priced in by the Fed for this year, you know, so we've just never really subscribed to that view, because if we do believe we're in the midst of a productivity expansion, neutral is higher, and we need to rethink that entire consensus around, you know, bonds are back.
I mean, in fact, in your to quote your paper, I mean, in your Q3 white paper, which precedes the September rate cut, you and the two Davids suggested that the Fed will engage in a shallower cutting cycle due to the soft landing or no landing scenario, and increased productivity. And so you still feel that way?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
So we think neutral is higher in the US than it is in Canada.
And for Canada, conversely, you suggest a deeper cutting cycle, as you don't feel the same way as you've already alluded to about the Canadian economy.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, and the difference is the US is in the midst of a productivity expansion. We don't believe we're seeing that in Canada. It's not impossible we get that in Canada, but you know, we have 30 years of data to back up productivity growth happening in the US and not happening in Canada. Again, I mean, we don't really know the source of the weak productivity growth in Canada. There's a whole host of reasons. Check out that March 2024 speech by Deputy Governor Carolyn Rogers from the Bank of Canada. Spectacular dissection of the issue in Canada. But I'm a taker of statistics, right? I'm not a maker of them. So I see the productivity gap happening in the US and Canada. We believe something really special is happening in the US. And that means neutral is going to be higher, which, as you said, Pierre, that shallower cutting cycle means the eventual landing spot is likely higher in the US than in Canada, which has really important implications for the Canadian dollar. I mean, that's really...
Yeah, there's going to be a divergence.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's going to be a weaker Canadian dollar as a result, right, in the FX market.
You know, the way that we think about... The Canadian dollar is an interesting one because there's a few answers here. There's like, how do we think about it? What are the factors that affect it? And what's the direction of travel, right? So the Canadian dollar is a cyclical currency, right? It moves when there's risk off sentiment, it depreciates, right? So March 2020, back half of 2022, any sort of global risk off event or even a homegrown risk off event, you see the function of a flexible exchange rate is to alleviate some of that pressure and sort of put Canada on sale and depreciate the Canadian dollar. And so from a strategic perspective, the way that we use the Canadian dollar in our funds is if we're underweight the Canadian dollar and we get a depreciation, our funds get hurt less, right? So 2022, good example of this, well, that none of us want to revisit, but 2022 was... You know, from a multi-asset class perspective, from a bond and stock perspective, it was sort of a year of down and downer. So the way that you were able to preserve basis points and do better than your peers was to be underweight the Canadian dollar, which is an overweight to the US dollar, own right. cash and own commodities. And so we were underweight the Canadian dollar in 2022, and that helped us preserve basis points for the end investors. Now, relating it
and you
back
expect
to,
that to you expect that trend to continue
Exactly. I mean, so yeah. we are underweight the Canadian dollar. We believe the direction of travel is lower. And right. why is that? Well, so the first is related to this interest rate differential, right? So we think the term, we think after all is said and done, the Fed will end here and Canada will end here. Sorry for the air graphs here, but the US will end here and Canada will end yeah. here. That higher interest rate suggests capital inflow into the US. That's an appreciation of the US dollar. That's a downward arrow for the Canadian dollar. But the other, I think,
But if you're a Canadian investor, that the overweight to the US dollar will actually translate back into more Canadian dollars on the back end, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So by being underweight the Canadian dollar, that's an overweight to the US dollar, you are less exposed, right, to those Canadian right. dollar movements. But the other way to think about it, I think, is for the last 20 years, there's basically been one engine of growth in Canada, right? And it's been housing and the consumer spending associated with housing. So buy the house and then fill the house with all the stuff, right. Which in my experience all ends up on Kijiji. But anyway, so so buy the house and then fill it with stuff. And now it's time basically for something else to be the driver of growth. And when this lag appears in Canada, right, you know, the Canadian macro versus the US, the most natural mechanism to aid in that adjustment is a depreciation of the Canadian dollar. And the way to think about that is the Canadian dollar depreciates, Canada goes on sale, right? The lumber that we export to the US or the cost of filming a movie in Vancouver or a TV show in Vancouver, that gets cheaper for the companies that do that.
Right.
And that aids in that adjustment, right? So historically, I mean, trade was a major driver of growth in Canada, you know, with 3/4 of those exports going to the US. A depreciation of the Canadian dollar would facilitate that. The last thing Pierre mentioned.
So long term, is that a net positive for Canada?
Well, it's hard to say if it's a net positive. I would sort of call it an adjustment or a realignment, right? Okay. Now maybe that's the ex central banker in me speaking, but the way to think about this is you want a better distribution of the drivers of growth. Right. You never, ever want something, one thing historically sort of driving growth in an outsized way. I mean, that was housing again, because of extremely low rates and strong incomes. But, you know, for a country like Canada, the historical driver being trade in this small open economy, I mean, we sort of need to move back towards that. Right. Now, the one thing I'll add there is, a lot of times people have said, well, you know, you're expecting the direction of travel for the Canadian dollar to be lower. So, you know, for it to start for the Canadian dollar to begin with the number 6 in the next 12 to 18 months, we don't view as impossible. And people have sometimes pushed back saying, well, you know, but there's a lack of energy supply. And if the business cycle, if things sort of come back online, you know, you saw the China stimulus recently.
I'm meaning to ask you about that as well.
Yeah, so really significant sort of, level of stimulus. If that pushes commodity prices higher and oil prices higher because of this sort of resurgence in industrialization, that's really good for the Canadian dollar and the Canadian economy. And the answer, had you asked me this basically in the 90s, in the 2000s, and the early 2010s, would have been yes. Right? Because the Canadian dollar and oil prices moved in lockstep. And I have a great chart that I can actually share after this, right? They were joined at the hip, right? The petrol currency, right? We remember this notion. But in the last 4 years, the Canadian dollar has decoupled entirely from movements in the price of oil, right? A great example of that is 2022, Russia invades Ukraine. Oil goes to over $100. And not only does the Canadian dollar not go towards par, which is this sort of ocular model would have suggested, it actually moves in the other direction, right? Back half of 2022, with oil at $100, Canadian dollar goes from 82 cents down to 72 cents because of the sentiment factor, the risk off factor. And the last point here to make is, why has the Canadian dollar decoupled from movements in the price of oil. It's because oil extraction and oil capex is less of a tailwind for the Canadian economy, right? So oil capex in Canada, so again, right. I don't know how oil comes out of the ground, like the straws that they put in the ground. I mean, for me, it comes out of the pump, but anyway,
yeah.
How it comes out of the ground, the amount of capex by Canadian companies in extracting oil and gas has fallen since 2014 in 10 years by 50%. So that's less of a tailwind for the Canadian economy and less of a factor driving the movements in the value of our dollar, of the Canadian dollar.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think people expect to hear that. First of all, I think it also speaks to, I mean, the interesting thing that's happening with natural gas,
right?
And Mexico, natural gas exports to Mexico, because it's so inexpensive. So you can see where, Canada is having, Canada as an energy exporter, would be having a hard time, just an equally hard time. I mean, I saw a piece, a news item this week, which was about how Alberta was jockeying to provide natural gas to the technology industry as a source of electricity to drive AI, AI server farms.
Yes, it is interesting. I mean, I think we can't underestimate what's happened in the U.S., right? So the shale revolution in the U.S. Is remarkable, right? They've added two Canadas and essentially to their yeah. oil production. And the natural gas developments are fascinating. What I would say though, again, and I'm sure you speak to commodity experts regularly who can get into this 10 levels more detail than I can, but what I think is interesting from a macroeconomic perspective and affecting our position is, I was working at the Bank of Canada in 2008 under Governor Carney. Canada came through the financial crisis sort of first or second best in the G7. We kind of skated through it. Part of that, and there was a little bit of high-fiving going on, part of that was we had five well-capitalized banks. We didn't have the dodgy mortgages.
Right.
I mean, I think we have some of those dodgy mortgages now, but we didn't have those dodgy mortgages then.
Yeah.
And the other thing, again, I think that goes underappreciated is we had China growing at, 14 or 15% buying every commodity that we could export,
right?
That was a significant tailwind. That was a significant get out of jail free card that we shouldn't underestimate, that it's still there. It's just a lot weaker than it was, right? And that has really important, I think, short-term and secular implications.
Right. So this new China stimulus that we got at the end of September, is a potential tailwind for Canada in relative to commodities.
It is. I mean, so,
yeah.
In our positioning, what we've done most recently is a couple of things, and these are nuances here. We remain cautious on Canada, right? So in our 60-40, 21% of the equities are Canadian equities. The underlying managers, we have a great slate of managers who have historically done very well against their benchmarks. They're incentivized to beat their benchmarks. If we own them, they boost the performance of our fund if they do well. But we've trimmed that Canadian 21% by, call it 4%.
Okay.
And allocated it into other areas. One of which, Pierre, is commodities, right? And so
Right. Sometimes
this is a bit of a head scratcher. How can you be underweight Canada and overweight commodities? And the answer is we want exposure to that part of Canada that could do well if commodities push higher. And so we're overweight commodities, so gold, oil, and global natural resources, the Fidelity Fund. But we're cautious on Canada because of that household debt concern and the lag that we expect and has in fact happened versus, say, the US and other areas, right? So it's kind of, positioning is a bit of an endogenous soup where everything affects everything else.
That's what I was just going to say. That I mean, it's there's so many moving parts that you have to consider. So, given what we've talked about up to this moment, and I mean, including all of your thoughts, how has this change that we've had this year? How is the Fed rate cut and all of the underlying conditions that you see, how has it shifted your views on asset allocation? I mean, I think you just mentioned that you've trimmed the underweight in Canada. And now, did you also mentioned that you had trimmed your U.S. overweight?
Yes.
And you were favoring with the reallocation, you were favoring commodities. So I know we're in the midst of that conversation right now. What do you think is going to be the driver of a pickup in commodities?
Yeah. So this is an interesting one. So again, if I rewind to a year ago, when we first initiated this meaningful overweight to U.S. equities because of this productivity expansion idea, that ran, you know, really till like May, June of this year. And then, you know, macro and bottom up are only two parts of our investment, our research-based investment process. The other two parts, the other two pillars are sentiment and valuations, right?
Right.
Now, valuations are not a great timing tool, right? As any EM investor will tell you. And sentiment, you know, sentiment is tricky, very difficult to measure, but we basically took profits, right? So we had a meaningful overweight.
US equities are stretched.
Exactly.
Especially in the high beta stocks. Yeah.
That's right. It's very concentrated. It's had a significant run over, you know, over many, many months. We took profits. Now, the core thesis in the US still stands. We have a slight overweight to US equities, but we want it to be just more regionally balanced across other asset classes.
Right.
Still overweight equities. Right. So the most important thing to talk about in terms of our positioning is in our 60-40, which can be, call it a 70-30 or a 50-50, right? Generally, we think of them as having plus or minus 10% bands. We're about halfway up that 10% band and right now that 60-40 is a 65-35. Interestingly, on a different conversation that was recorded, I screwed up that math and said 65-25, but I practiced my math before this call. You know, we're halfway up that risk spectrum, and it's generally roughly evenly spread across, you know, Europe, emerging markets and commodities, a slight overweight to the US, and then still cautious on Canada. On the commodity side, I think there's a couple of interesting things that can help us dissect the motivation there. You know, inevitably, in every conversation I've had, the U.S. election comes up. And sometimes when someone asks a question about the U.S. election, I say, I think we're out of time. But you know, that because it's a tricky one to answer, but I think we should just dig right into it. So I don't know who's going to win the election. I don't, to be quite honest, it's not our edge in predicting what an asset class is going to do if person A or person B wins. I think we've spoken about this in the past. Our edge, we will always position and think deeply about policy, and we will not position for politics, right? So policy, right. Not politics. Policy is all the stuff we just discussed around R-star and the neutral rate and all that kind of stuff. And politics is sort of the election noise. It's not our edge. But there are a couple of important points worth highlighting. Regardless of who wins the U.S. election, I don't think the U.S. is getting any less protectionist, right? So under one scenario, we're getting tariffs. Under another scenario, we're getting sort of industrial policy, onshoring, reshoring, kind of veiled protectionism. The U.S. is not suddenly becoming more open, right? And if that's the case, if the borders are getting thicker, that has really important implications for Canada, but also it has important implications for inflation. And if it has important implications for inflation, you want to own, out of benchmark, the asset class that does the best job of protecting investors against inflation.
Right.
Again, 2022, which are commodities. The second thing on,
how are you getting the commodities exposure?
I
know some of that is from Canadian commodities producers.
Yes. Yeah. So it's fairly diversified, right? So it's two ETFs, a gold and an oil ETF. And I'd be happy to send the sizes afterwards. And then a small allocation to the Fidelity Global Natural Resource Fund. run by Joe and Darren. Now,
okay,
that position will evolve, right? So that's as of the end of July. It's evolved. It's evolved a little bit. I'm happy to follow up, you know, when we're out of that compliance window. But the other thing, the other motivation, I think, for the commodities exposure is, again, I don't know who's going to win. Regardless of who wins, I used to say I don't know which 80-year-old's going to win, but I can't say that now. So, regardless of who wins,
yeah,
regardless of who wins, there will the fiscal taps will be opened after that election, right? So there will be fiscal spending, you know, pro-cyclical fiscal spending in the U.S. It will be called different things, but fiscal spending on top of an already pretty tight U.S. economy is, you guessed it, inflationary.
Right.
And so to me, that's kind of a medium-term underappreciated inflation risk. And because of that, we want to own the asset class that, again, 2022 was the case study on how you need to own commodities to protect investors against the damaging effects of inflation.
So, thanks, Ilan. Thanks for explaining that. I think, you know, that might not always be clear, because right now, you know, we've been in a period where energy prices were low, gasoline prices, everybody's sort of, you know, up until, of course, the outbreak of this new escalation with Iran, Iran-Israel conflict. So that's commodities. In Canadian fixed income, I think we've touched on it, but what do you see? Like if we're looking forward to a deeper cutting cycle for Canada, what does that mean for first of all, it means obviously lower short-term rates, but what does it mean for longer term rates and duration in general in terms of your exposure?
You know, on the fixed income side of the portfolio, we really are sort of where we were almost a year ago, right? We're still underweight the investment grade debt, both Canada and globally. But again, where we've really added to the income side, and sometimes this sort of gets left behind or forgotten because of how well equities have done. And so we've been overweight equities. That U.S. equity overweight was obviously very additive, but the overweight to the credit and the spread sectors, right? So, you know, really talented managers like Adam Kramer, who is actually really worth chatting with if you get the chance. That's also been additive on the income side as well, right? And what I would say though is the way to think about our portfolios is the managed portfolios, the private investment pools. These are tactical portfolios, right? So now they're not getting swung around every day or week or month. Right. Moves are incremental, moves are research based, but as we get, as we get further into the rate normalization cycle and more sort of certainty on these landing points, you will see, you can expect to see the fixed income side of the portfolio evolve. Right now, we've thought for some time that it's better to take that risk budget on the equity side of the portfolio, and that's been additive, but again, this will evolve based on that four input research-based process of macro, bottom-up sentiment and valuation. Again,
right.
In 10 years, you might be talking to someone else, Pierre, but I hope not, but and a lot may change, but what will not change is that four-pillar research-based process.
Great. That's great. I think the main thing also to consider is the fact that you may have a view today, which could change tomorrow, and therefore the tactical asset allocation model could change on relatively short notice as well, depending on what happens in the economy, in the bond market, what happens with rates.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, and there are examples of this, right? So, you know, again, I think a lot of times
it's not a buy and hold asset allocation model. It's not a strategic, long-term asset allocation. It is indeed a tactical model, which changes according to
economic
considerations, the bond market, the equity market, whatever's actually happening, not not just a long-term strategic view.
Well, that's a perfect way to put it, right? So I've sometimes described these portfolios as simple solutions to complex problems. I mean, think about the breadth of our conversation today. Every single answer I provided is based on research and collaboration with our research team and my colleagues, David and David. Sometimes that question is asked as, is 60-40 dead, right? So like my grandfather's 60-40, that one's dead, right? The all Canada strategically allocated, set it and forget it. That I think is probably dead. I mean, and what we have now is, again, the managed portfolios and the private investment pools do the best example of this is they're diversified across managers, across geography, across styles, sectors, and they have an asset allocation overlay that's research-based, right? So the other thing to note, and maybe this is a good spot to end on, is there's an ongoing research agenda. This is the symbol for research agenda. Sorry. There's an ongoing research agenda. There's an ongoing research agenda underneath the funds to continually sharpen the tool. Right. I know we talked about this last time. In the middle of May, we introduced liquid alternatives into the managed portfolios. We have a partnership with Brookfield Asset Management to manage a sleeve of private real estate in the private investment pools. So there's a, you know, we're continually trying to innovate and sharpen the tool for the end investor. And I think that's what, you know, that's what we've shown to do really over a number of years.
Has the addition in May of this year to alternatives in the portfolio had the desired effect of smoothing out returns? I mean, we had a pretty rough early August and subsequently early September in markets because of the Japan carry trade reversal that happened. How did the alternatives help out during that period?
So I would say, I mean, it's early days, right? This is a small amount of data.
Yeah, I recognize as well asking you this question, it's very soon. Too soon,
again,
maybe.
I mean, but it's early days, and we have some preliminary data, and we did answer this. We kind of attacked this question in our last paper. It has helped in smoothing out some of the end ride for the end investor. Again, very early days, and a small data set from when we initiated these positions. What I've noticed is, you know, what I've done a lot of is just sort of advisor, investor education around basically why did we add these things and what are they, right? So again, these are very new to retail investors, right? Historically, this is an asset class for sovereign wealth funds, pension plans, and giant family offices, right? So it is very fidelity to democratize that asset class, and we were excited about it. So yeah.
It's hard to, I mean, I think the benefit is that you get, maybe you get, you know, over the longer term, you'll get slightly more return, but the real benefit is less risk.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and again,
less risk for the entire, like less adjusted risk for the entire portfolio.
Exactly. And actually, that speaks to a really important point, Pierre. We should always be thinking in risk adjusted return, not return.
Right.
Risk adjusted return is the metric we should be thinking about. And I know our Q2 paper had some nice scatter plots. I mean, who doesn't love a good scatter plot? Showing the slight nudge left of risk and the slight nudge higher of return. And again, these are nudges, right? Stocks and bonds are still the foundations of all the portfolios that we manage. But if we can sharpen the tool, we will.
Yeah. Ilan, wow. What a great conversation. What a comprehensive take. I loved your anecdotes and your new data that you shared. I think there's a lot of takeaways here for everyone. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insights.
Thank you, Pierre. I mean, I really enjoy these chats. Next time we'll do it in person for sure.